Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 7th, 2000. In the fireside room this evening, we have Mavis Anderson. Today's session number is 2004. Tonight, she's continuing her series, Cuba, Neither Heaven Nor Hell. Tonight's segment is The Church in Cuba, the Pre- and Post-Pope Period. Let's listen in.
One of the things that I have found that's so kind of refreshing about Cuba is that everybody sort of thinks of Fidel as, not everybody, people who are in favor of the government there now think of Fidel kind of as a friend. And they never call him Castro, like we'd say Clinton, or they never say President Castro. They always say Fidel, always. And anybody who calls him Castro, they look upon sort of like, you know, who are you? Because that's what the community in Miami calls him, is Castro. And so they think using his last name is kind of a negative way to talk about him. And so everybody talks about Fidel. And they also have all of these jokes. You know, you hear them from taxi drivers, you hear them from people in the market, you hear them from people in the churches. They have jokes about Fidel. And there are a couple jokes that I heard about Fidel in relationship to either the Pope or to religion. So I thought I would tell these two jokes. But I'm not good at telling jokes, so they may flop, but I'll try anyway. In the first one, Fidel dies. Then he goes to heaven. Fidel goes to heaven. This is pretty interesting even to start out with. And as soon as he gets to heaven, he starts asking St. Peter for a private interview with God. And St. Peter says, no, we don't give private interviews with God. But Fidel pesters him and pesters him. And finally, St. Peter relents and says, okay, you can have a private interview with God, but 1/2 hour and not a minute longer. So Fidel agrees to that. So he goes into God's office and closes the door behind him. And time goes on, and time goes on, and 1/2 hour passes, and Fidel doesn't come out, and 45 minutes, and Fidel doesn't come out. 55 minutes, and St. Peter is just beside himself, and he's angry, and he's desperate to, you know, rescue God from Fidel. So he goes barging into the room and says, Lord, what's going on here? And God looks at Peter and says, my friend, just give us a few more minutes. I'm enjoying talking to Fidel, and Fidel has me convinced that we need a revolution here in heaven. But I haven't quite yet understood why Fidel thinks that I should be vice president. That's so typical, because he is such a charismatic, kind of overwhelming leader. Well, the other joke has to do with the Pope. And, you know, the Pope was in Cuba in January of 98. And that's kind of what this session is all about, what's going on with the church. So the Pope arrived, and Fidel took the Pope to see the Malecón, which is the kind of the boardwalk and wall right along the sea in Havana. And the waves come crashing up, and it's a place where lovers walk at night, and it's just kind of the romantic spot in Havana. So Fidel and the Pope take this walk along the Malecón, and all of a sudden a great big gust of wind comes by and pulls the little white hat off of the Pope's head and dumps it out at sea. And Fidel, totally unperturbed, says, oh, don't worry, I'll get it for you. So he jumps over the wall and walks across the water to get the Pope's little hat, brings it back, gives it back to him. And there are three headlines in papers the next day, and I'm going to have to read these so I get them right. The Vatican paper, the official daily paper of the Vatican's headline about this event is, His Holiness performs the first miracle in Havana.
Okay.
The Cuban official newspaper, the Granma, has the headline that reads, "Fidel is God and proves it to the Pope." And in Miami, the headline of the Miami Herald said, "Fidel is so sick he can't swim." So you hear these just on every topic, all over Havana, and they're kind of interesting because they at times kind of poke at Fidel, you know, and you get a little subtle criticism in the jokes, but always they're affectionate, you know, and people feel totally free to talk about these sorts of things in public. Anyway, the church, you know, it's in Cuba. It's really as so many things about Cuba, it's really a complex issue. Before the revolution, you know, there was a Catholic church and there were Protestant churches. And when the revolution triumphed on January 1st, 1959, estimates are that about 95% of Cubans were revolutionaries. I mean, they supported the revolution immediately. And though some of them fell away later, right at the beginning, 95% of Cubans were revolutionaries. And 95% were believers, in quotes. And believers in Cuba is a pretty broad category. Or if you say someone's religious when you're in Cuba, it's a broad category. It can mean belongs to a church, is a practicing Catholic or a practicing Protestant, or is someone who believes in a higher being, or is someone who practices the Afro-Cuban religion of Santeria, come over from Africa with the slaves that were imported. So it's a broad category. But there were, I mean, it was a definitely a religious society at the time that the revolution triumphed. A lot of things happened, and they happened very quickly. There was a not a very strong connection between the people in the congregations or at the grassroots and the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, because at the time of Cuba's struggle for independence from Spain, most of the priests were pro-Spanish, and so therefore they were anti-independence. So immediately you've got a distance between your hierarchy and the believers, who were, you know, a religious people, but they weren't, they didn't have this strong connection to their bishops and their priests, even, because they felt they were not pro-Cuba. And so you had kind of an anti-clericalism. And you also had, and this is found in many places in the world, but a real syncretism between the Afro-Cuban Santeria believers and the Catholics. They could be one and the same. You could have someone who was definitely a Catholic and, you know, professed the Catholic faith and would also participate in Santeria rituals and wear the Santeria, you know, symbols around their neck and consult with the Santeria babalaos or priests. So it was a real syncretic kind of mix. The Protestants arrived later into this mix. They really didn't show up in Cuba until after the War of Independence and when the United States intervened in 1898. Then after that time, when the U.S. was had a military presence in Cuba for a few years, that's when U.S. religions, U.S. Protestants, started to arrive and also, you know, have a strong presence in Cuba, too. However, at the time of the revolution, there was really a contradiction between being revolutionary and being religious. And that only exacerbated as time went on. Part of it was because the revolution itself became kind of a religion. People believed in it. Mm-hmm. People put their hopes in the revolution. People were devoted to it. It inspired love and devotion in their hearts, loyalty. It implied work and it demanded sacrifice. So those really strong revolutionaries kind of embraced the revolution as their own religion. And another reason there was this split difficulty between the revolution and the church is that the priests and the church hierarchy had, as in many other Latin American countries, had historical ties to wealth and to repression of the people. Their families were the wealthy people. You know, that's not a new kind of thing. But at any rate, it started with suspicion and mistrust right from the beginning. And shortly after the revolution triumphed, the churches, the hierarchy of the churches, participated in some of the anti-revolutionary activities, thinking they could oust Fidel. And so arms were stored in some of the churches, and there'd be raids on the churches to look for arms, which may or may not have been there. There were public campaigns to discredit the Catholic priests who were seen as counter-revolutionaries. And it really all started to come apart after the Bay of Pigs. Cuban Americans, or the Cubans in exile in Miami, were brought over to Cuba to invade and try and overthrow Fidel. And three of the people who participated in that invasion at the Bay of Pigs were priests, were Catholic priests. And that didn't do anything to help relationships. So that the government took away Catholic access to radio and TV. They deported a bishop, 131 priests, expelled them from Cuba after the Bay of Pigs. And the revolution declared itself to be socialist, Marxist-Leninist, which again, the suspicion just grew greatly. So what the Catholic bishops who were left did is they just stopped talking. They didn't make pronouncements, they didn't issue bishop letters, they didn't do anything, they just became quiet. And a lot of them left, went to the United States, and not only the priests and bishops, but also a lot of the real mainstays of the Catholic Church, who were mostly wealthy. They were landowners, their land had been expropriated, they left. Or they had strong ideological differences with the revolution, they left. So there was this massive exodus, which kind of took away the main support that the church had had. They were also mostly white, the people who left in that first exodus. Protestants left too in large numbers, but it didn't make such an impact that the Protestants left, because the Protestant church had been very apolitical, hadn't been involved in speaking out against the repressions of the Batista regime, nothing. They were just sort of there. It was a very
silent,
absolutely. In fact, one of the pastors who was there at the time, a Baptist pastor, who is now very much a Protestant leader in the country, Raul Suarez, said, and he almost says it in an embarrassed way, he said that at the time of the revolution, the big issue in the Protestant churches was, can a Christian smoke? I mean, that was the level of the discussion in the Protestant churches.
He is still in Cuba.
He is still there.
He is
there.
A major leader.
Yep, yep. He stayed throughout the whole time and is now a strong spokesperson in the Protestant church. But it wasn't, you know, the level of debate in the Protestant churches wasn't, should a Christian be a revolutionary, but, you know, should a Christian smoke? Well, some of the other things that the government did is they nationalized all the private schools, and that included Catholic, Protestant, and secular schools. That doesn't go over well with the Catholic Church, certainly, because that's such a mainstay of teaching of Catholic doctrine, and that increased the gulf. Again, there was another mass exodus of the nuns who were the teachers in the schools, and more priests left. And most of the people who left in those early years thought it would just be temporary. They didn't feel like they were packing up their life and moving for good, because they thought that the United States would intervene and put things back in order. And, you know, a year or so, Fidel was going to be gone. Well, it's interesting. Fidel was raised in the Catholic Church. He was educated both grade school and high school in a Jesuit school. So he was raised a Christian, But early on in the revolution, he declared the revolution to be atheist. And a little bit later, I want to say more when, as things have changed, what Fidel is saying now about religion. But for, you know, the first 20, 25 years of the revolution, he was an atheist. And my guess is that he'd still say that about himself, that he's an atheist. But he also says some other things that kind of reveal there's something going on in his spirituality also.
In Puerto Rico, just a little, when first Cubans start coming in, they would say that religion in Cuba was persecuted, they were killing everybody, and that Fidel would go to the schools and say, pray to God and tell him to give you an ice cream. No, here is an ice cream. To prove that, you know, that God cannot do nothing for them, but Fidel could. Propaganda on Fidel and blah, blah, blah. He will go to all this. I mean, you exaggerated the point, but that's, you know, that's what they were saying.
Yeah.
For those who are Christians or whatever, so, you know, hey, hate Fidel too, because he don't promote Christianism. Yeah. He don't allow churches.
Yeah.
And some of us knew better, but that's what they were saying.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's some truth in it, in that churches weren't closed. They weren't. People were allowed to continue to go to church, but it was kind of like it was a flaw. If you were a Christian, you were seen as a flawed person, and people were shamed in public if they revealed that they were a believer. Christians who admitted that they were Christians were denied some things. They were denied good jobs. They were denied opportunities for study. They were denied opportunities for travel. They were they were looked down upon. So what happened with people of faith is they took their faith inside. You know, they already didn't have much connection with the hierarchy, so they sort of stopped going to church. And they privatized their religion and didn't talk about it in public. But the last few years, it's just been very clear that you know, the faith of the people and the religiosity of the people survived. And
is that the same for non-Christian believers?
Like
the Santería?
Yes, absolutely. There's a tremendous upsurge in Santería right now. In fact, number-wise, it's probably the largest group, if you put people in groups, it would be the largest spiritual expression in Cuba right now, is Santería.
But were they...
They were persecuted,
were
too.
Were they persecuted?
Yeah, yeah. It was outlawed. Santería was outlawed. So that also went underground. Yeah. And, you know, when stuff goes underground, sometimes it gains strength in that way when it's persecuted. So, and the people in general, you know, the majority, the great majority, took the revolution side in a confrontation with the hierarchy, you know. The revolution was doing some things for them. The church hierarchy wasn't. So, you know, the gulf was quite tremendous. And that lasted through the 60s, into the mid-70s. In fact, people were prohibited from speaking about religion outside of the walls of their church. There was one interesting thing that I read. I'm a real fan of Che Guevara, mostly because, well, for several reasons. But he has the same birthday as I do, so I feel this connection.
He's awful handsome.
He's awful handsome, too. Yeah, you're right. control yourself, right. But very early on, even in the 60s, when the discrimination against church people was at its height, Che Guevara had an insight that people ignored. But he said, and I'm going to read this so I get it right too, when Christians dare to offer an integral revolutionary witness, the Latin America revolutions will be invincible. Mm-hmm. He got the fact that joining those two strong forces together would really make a powerful, powerful force. Mm-hmm. But he was ignored.
I wonder how much of that was influenced in sort of the Latin American struggles, which was certainly
it was
revolution, spiritual, I mean, religious
Absolutely. People ignored it in Cuba because Cuba was so isolated from everyone at this point. But in Latin America, in the other Latin American countries where Che was also revered, they listened to it. And you can see evidences of it in Nicaragua, you can see it in Brazil, you can see it in El Salvador. People understood. And actually, as things started to change in Cuba in relation to the church, that was a really key thing. When the Nicaraguan Revolution triumphed in 1979, that was the moment that Cubans started to understand that Christianity and revolution could work together. After what is it, July 19th, 1979, Cuba was supporting the Nicaraguans in their struggle, you know, with arms, with advisors, with moral support. It was clear they were supporting that revolution. And after it triumphed, the exchange between those two peoples was tremendous, and it went on for a period of 10 years. Cubans flooded Nicaragua with doctors, with teachers, with military advisors, with sports trainers, with, you name it, technicians for water projects and electric projects and whatever. Cuba is extremely generous in sharing its people and its technology with other Latin American countries. So Nicaragua was flooded with Cubans. And the same thing happened on the Nicaraguans. They would go to Cuba to study. People with war injuries would go there to be medically treated. People would go there to kind of do political sightseeing, to learn about the Cuban political system, and they'd go there on vacation. So there was this tremendous exchange between these two countries. And Cuba started to open its eyes when it saw that the Nicaraguan revolutionaries also, in great percentage, were Christians. Mm-hmm. And they could see,
there's... And Protestant, not the Catholic Church, the Protestant too.
Both.
Well, yeah. The house churches that were so strong in those countries, under this umbrella of this liberation theology, that really didn't get started in Cuba
it
at
didn't.
All, did it?
It didn't. The revolution in Cuba happened in the late 50s, you know, early 60s, and liberation theology was starting to foment, but it really took off in 65 and 68 with the Medellin Conference and a little bit later Puebla, which did impact Cuba a bit. But the early years of liberation theology, Cuba was isolated from Latin America. Latin America countries, except for those in revolution, you know, broke relations with Cuba. They were just plain isolated. So all of that wonderful, you know, church evolvement didn't happen in Cuba, and actually still hasn't. In 88, I think, was the Puebla meeting in Mexico, and several Cuban bishops went to that, and they were impacted, and they brought that word back to Cuba. And so, I mean, it started to touch people a little bit then, but it really was in 79 that the change started to happen in the relationship with the church. And it's, you know, it's still going on, and they've still got a long ways to go. But that was the key. The other thing that I thought is really important, that Jose Marti, who was just revered in Cuba as the father of their independence, was a profoundly religious man. And that's evident in his poetry, it's evident in his orations, his speeches. But somehow, you know, that too didn't get transmitted to the people. The other thing that clearly kept the church and the government at a distance was that in the 70s, Cuba turned more and more to the Soviet Union and more adopted a Soviet style of Marxism, which was definitely an atheist Marxism. And again, atheism became a state religion, and it was taught in the schools, in the educational system. It was written into the Constitution. It was just so much a part of the institution of that country throughout the 70s that it was, you know, there was no escaping this conflict. Also, the other thing that happened in the rest of Latin America, do you know that the educator Paulo Freire, you heard of him? He wrote a book called Pedagogy of the Oppressed and really introduced a new way of doing education that rose up from the people taking their experience into consideration. That didn't come to Cuba either. Mm-hmm. They missed out on that too. Anyway, 79, things started to change. you know, the early years you had a church that was kind of locked or frozen in a dogma, confronting a government that was also extremely dogmatic, and they just, you know, there was no way they were going to work together in the beginning. Let's see. Oh, okay, a little bit about Fidel. Hi. No problem. In the 80s, a Brazilian Dominican priest by the name of Frei Beto, B-E-T-T-O, went to Cuba and requested an interview with Fidel, and it was granted. And he interviewed him for some, I don't know, 25, 28 hours, hours and hours of one-on-one conversations with Fidel, which he then wrote into a book, and it's called Fidel and Religion. And it was written in Spanish initially, and it made such an impact that it was translated into, I don't know how many different languages, but lots, including English. And what really struck people, this was in 85, was the way that Fidel, the whole book is on Fidel talking about religion, the way he spoke with respect and civility and even appreciation for Christianity. And you could start to see the roots of that early training on his part had left some mark on his heart, even as a professed atheist. He appreciated and valued Christianity, which took a while, you know, before it started to come out. Also, Jesse Jackson, Reverend Jesse Jackson, went to Cuba in the mid-80s and met with Fidel, and Fidel participated with Jesse in a Methodist worship service and stood up in front of the congregation with his hand on a Bible, and people kind of, whoa, you know, something new is happening here. So that progressed throughout the 80s, where you could start to see that something different was happening, and it didn't start to really show itself in civil society until the 90s. And one of the things that happened then is that the party, the Communist Party, reversed one of its statutes or laws that had said that people with religious belief could not be members of the Communist Party. Therefore, you couldn't be elected to any of the representative bodies, nothing. You couldn't participate in government. They changed that, and they said that that believers could become members of the Communist Party, and non-Communist Party members could be elected to their parliament. And what's interesting is that there was no rush of Christians to join the Communist Party. That didn't happen. You know, there may have been a few, but there was not a big rush. But what did happen was that a number, and a pretty good number, of people who were already members of the Communist Party admitted that they were believers and Christians and just had kept that to themselves in order to participate in the party. Let's see, what else? The 1992 Constitution. Cuba changed itself from calling itself an atheist state to calling itself a secular state, and started to embrace a diversity of opinion. In 1996, Fidel traveled to Rome and went to the Vatican and had a one-on-one meeting with the Pope. And at that meeting, he invited the Pope to come visit Cuba. Cuba was the only country in Latin America that the Pope had not visited. And you know, when he goes somewhere, he bends down and kisses the soil. And Cuba's soil was the only place that he had not kissed. So a lot of things happened underground between 96 and 98 when his visit happened. The foreign minister from Cuba went to the Vatican and had meetings with Vatican officials, and none of that was public. You know, just all of a sudden there was this announcement that the Pope was going to visit Cuba. So in 1998, January 98, the Pope spent, oh, I don't know, 4 or 5 days in Cuba. And if you remember, that was also the same time that the whole scandal with Monica Lewinsky hit the newspapers. Yep.
You didn't get to see the Pope.
Exactly. All of the major networks were in Cuba to cover the Pope. The story broke in the U.S. about Monica. They all left Cuba, came back to the U.S., and we saw almost nothing of this historic visit. Yep. Somebody took a poll at that point in 98, and after 30 years of official atheistic ideology, which was, you know, written into law in Cuba, still only 15% of Cubans said they were non-believers. 85% would still recognize that in some way they believed in a superior being, they had a faith that, again, had gone inside. But again, only 15% of them would say that they belonged to any group or church or organized religious group. It was all internal stuff. But at that point, with the announcement of the Pope's visit and continuing on after that, there was just a tremendous religious revival. The churches and temples in Cuba are bursting with worshipers. You know, it's standing room only. And I haven't been to a Catholic worship, actually, in Cuba, but I've been to Baptist worships and Pentecostals and Presbyterian. And literally, they are like no church that, you know, I'm real familiar with here in terms of the enthusiasm and the numbers of people. And people remind you that the churches were never closed and they were never empty. But there is certainly now an increase. The Bible sells like hotcakes. That, you know, in any kind of bookstore, the Bible is one of their best sellers. Adults and youth who haven't, you know, had access to church in an easy way are asking to be baptized. Santeria also is booming. The Pope's visit kind of gave permission for all of this to become public. His visit and the hints, the little clues that the Communist Party was giving that it was okay, and it's just, it has really erupted. It's like this privatized faith has just kind of bubbled up, you know, from the basement of people's souls and is now visible again. Also, the USSR is gone. You know, Soviet Union is gone. Soviet communism has, you know, more or less disappeared. And another part of it might be that things are, you know, in the early 90s, things were falling apart in Cuba. The economy was terrible. People were hungry. It was a time of crisis. In a time of crisis, people look for something to hang on to, something to give them comfort and hope. And that's, their faith became that kind of stability for them in a really difficult time. You know, there's a lot left to be achieved. But some of the things that have happened after the Pope's visit, I just want to share a few things. A dialogue has definitely started with the churches, both the Catholic Church in the people of the bishops and the Protestant churches. There's a Cuban Council of Churches, which is kind of the local expression of the World Council of Churches. And it's about 30 different Protestant denominations. And there are another 20 really conservative Protestant denominations, the more Pentecostal groups, that haven't joined the council. But the council itself is very, very active and very vocal. And there's a good dialogue, probably a better dialogue between the government and the Protestants than between the government and the Catholics.
How much were they involved in the alien situation?
A lot.
Given that Joan Brown or
a lot.
Whatever.
Joan Brown Campbell, yeah. A lot. They, I think before Elian's father came here, they were with him. The Council of Churches, Cuban Council of Churches was with him in Cuba, helping to advise him on how to react, how to respond, what to say. And I don't know how involved they were with his decision to finally come here, but I know that the National Council of Churches in New York was very involved with that and finally said to him, you have to come now. You know, it's really important that you come here and demonstrate your fatherhood and your desire to have this child back and let people see that you're free to come, and that you can say the same thing in the United States that you're saying in Cuba in terms of you want your son and you want to go back to Cuba. So I think they were very involved in that. There's sort of a new evangelism that's going on. Churches form little committees of people that are going house to house in the communities to reach out, you know, to knock on doors. And they include going to visit the local, they're called the Committee for the Defense of the Revolution, and it's the Communist Party's presence in each neighborhood. Churches go right into those places and talk with them too. They're finding that there's a lot of a lack of knowledge about Christianity, about the Bible, and a real thirst for it. They're finding that there's a lot of economic need, which really hadn't been seen before, but you get into somebody's home and you can see more what they need. It's a movement more or less of lay people. It's the lay people who are going out into the communities and making these contacts. The church has kind of come out of the closet, and it's present in the social life of the country again. And it hasn't gotten to the point yet where the church can be active in social projects. The government still, the state still controls the social projects, the, you know, justice issues and social security types of things. The church can talk about it, but it's not allowed yet to really be active and play a significant role in society. But they're demanding more and more space. They're demanding access to media, and they're getting it. They're demanding...
Excuse me, what about schools?
They don't have their schools back yet, no. And actually, I'm not even sure. I haven't heard that that's been on the list of demands yet. That's a pretty significant one. Mm-hmm. Though what has happened is that the curriculum in Cuba has changed. It's no longer as strident as it was in promoting only communism. It's much more open to diversity now. And children are not... don't feel pressured as much to become, what do they call them? I can't remember. There's a name for the kids, the little kids in school who wear a kerchief around their neck to signify that they are revolutionaries. Their, you know, parents are part of the party. And it used to be that those kids were really favored. That's not true anymore. They're still there, but there's no pressure for a child to make that kind of statement, and there's no discrimination in schools against somebody who doesn't believe that the Communist Party is the religion of the state. Festival days have been reinstated. In the early 60s, Christmas and Easter were outlawed. You couldn't celebrate them openly. That's not true anymore. There can be open-air masses. You hear now the bishops speaking on the radio. They don't have their own radio stations back, but Cuban radio will cover the bishop's masses or statements that he makes.
It was the priests were so aligned, the bishops, yep. The hierarchy were so lined with the rich.
Yep.
And so now these people Those are priests still going to want a priest. They're still going to want a priest. Where are they coming from?
Priests have been allowed now, some, to come back into the country. For a while, the government said, no, you know, foreign priests are not welcome here. That's changed. And there are foreign priests that are coming, serving churches. The seminaries in Cuba are full.
Both Protestant. Yes. Can train them.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So there's a resurgence of the office of priests. But it's a different kind of priest.
So, yes, it'll be of the people.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So some good things, you know, for the church, too. Some good things have happened. And, you know, it hasn't been an easy path at all. The other things that the church is really proud of right now is that they're developing a cadre of journalists, of Christian journalists. They go to media workshops. Some of them come to the States to learn from Christian writers here. And so they have their own church newsletters and disseminate that, and they're free to do that. The other thing that is interesting is that the church, unofficially, I don't think there's been any official statement of this, but the church has also given some in saying, you know, we're not going to stab Fidel in the back, or we're not going to, you know, be this really negative voice. They maintain a critical stance, And that's one of the things I appreciate so much about Reverend Suarez, who is a Baptist, that he's a revolutionary in a sense that he really appreciates the gains that the people had, but he's not afraid to say, now this is wrong. You know, we ought to do this differently. And he'll even have a meeting with Fidel and say, this doesn't work for Christians, you know. Here are some things that need to change. And he and one other Protestant minister have been elected as delegates to their National Assembly. So they're congresspeople, mm-hmm. not members of the Communist Party, and there to speak the word of the church in the seat of power of the government. So some pretty significant things are happening. Religious persecution, Cubans say, does not exist today. It's gone. It's disappeared. There's freedom of worship, freedom of public celebrations, open-air masses, lots of students of biblical studies, no censorship on things that they publish, but they're still held at a distance from really participating as active in the social projects of the government. The other thing that I think is really important about the church is that they, both the Catholic bishops and the Protestant Council of Churches, has come out strongly and regularly against the U.S. embargo. They say this doesn't help our people. It, you know, it's an invasion of Cuba's sovereignty. Get rid of the embargo. It's not a humanitarian thing to do. Which is helpful for us in Washington to be able to go to representatives and senators and say, you know, look, even the Christians who in the past were so persecuted in Cuba say, this is no good, you know, folks. Get rid of this. Let's see, anything else that I wanted to say here? The Protestant denominations that are there in numbers are Baptist, Presbyterian, Methodist, and Episcopalians. There's a very small Lutheran presence. It's pretty conservative. It grew out of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. A lot of their pastors left. One was put in jail for like 15 years. But they're still there, and they're still alive, and they're still, you know, trying to take part in this new resurgence of religion. And I frankly don't know very much about how successful they're being in terms of growing or becoming more active.
Did we ever have a presence?
No. Just this small Missouri Synod presence. That was it. And I don't know, they had just a few pastors. It wasn't a big group. But they are still there.
Did you say Presbyterians?
Presbyterians are big, yeah. Presbyterians, Methodists, Episcopalians, and Baptists are the four main Protestants. What I would really like to do for the rest of the time is talk about a little bit about what should be the role of churches in the United States vis-a-vis Cuba. You know, as people of faith, what do we want to say about Cuba? A communist state? Where does that fit in our Christianity? Do we feel that, you know, we ought to be part of helping to heal the rift between our people and the Cuban people? Do we think that it's too political a thing for us to get involved in? What are any of your congregations doing?
Parallels between that and like the South African Council of Churches and the role of the churches in, mm-hmm. I mean, obviously that was in some ways a real different situation, mm-hmm. but I mean, certainly the revolution was supported by, the ANC was supported by communist forces and supported by Cuba, but the churches were very significant to that.
As a matter of fact, the churches in South Africa took the position that it was a status confessionis to be against the repressive regime and for the liberation of the people. It was a matter of faith to oppose. the repressive forces in
that
South
they
Africa.
Should oppose.
They should oppose, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I think that the embargo is a repressive force against the people of Cuba.
Yeah.
And that to punish a whole country of people with an embargo is, you know, sort of anti-faith, I think.
And of course, you've got that whole big bunch of people down in Miami area. I suppose the rich landowners, for the most part, and a bunch of the priests who were supporting the rich.
Yeah.
And that's like a huge festering sore down there. Mm-hmm. If we do anything, what in the world can be done to help start some dialogue with them?
Mm-hmm. That group isn't all that big, though, is it?
They're very vocal and they're pretty powerful, but in terms of the voters in the state of Florida, they're 0.5% of the voters in Florida. But they all vote, for one thing.
Yeah.
I mean, and they have money and they use the money in political contributions to get commitments from legislators to vote with them. So they're very very smart.
They seem to be inordinately powerful for the number, the arithmetic of it.
Yeah. Yep, I think you're right. I think they are.
Well, I mean, I just, you know, this alien situation just really, you know, sort of busted open a lot of new ways of thinking about the church's role. And I mean, if the National Council of Churches played such a big role in that situation, says to me that it sort of signaled a real opportunity in addition to the Pope being there. And so that, I mean, the Pope's being there in some ways was felt like more of a spiritual thing.
Yeah.
The National Council of Churches was almost like a bridge between spirituality and politics.
Yeah, I think you're right.
You know, and so it's almost like that just really said, wait a minute, there's something here that, you know, churches can support. I know the National Council of Churches is a little bit
left of center,
but you know. And if there's such a force in Cuba that needs to have that nurtured.
Well, how, you're here, you're talking about it, but how are you trying to spread the word to the churches of some of the things you've talked about?
We work with most of the Protestant church national bodies. And in fact, and this is, I think this is where in our country there's a, you know, a gulf between what our national churches make as pronouncements and what we in congregations hear and say and do. Because I just want to read you a couple of statements from what our national church bodies have said. What church do you come from? What church denomination?
Lutheran.
Okay, let me read you what the Lutheran Church says. The Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, at their 95 churchwide assembly, and it's been reaffirmed with each assembly since then. Our faith calls us to love our neighbor and to work for justice, peace, and reconciliation among all peoples. The economic embargo imposed by the U.S. on Cuba is causing great suffering, especially for children and the elderly. The ELCA should work actively toward the goal of ending the U.S. embargo against Cuba as part of its ongoing efforts to seek further reconciliation and the establishment of normal relations between the United States and Cuba. That's a wonderful statement.
But it's never talked about.
Right. So how do we get that? I mean, we work with the national bodies and their social concerns representatives, but how do we get it into congregations? How do we get congregations to see that this could be seen as an issue of faith, to reconcile these two peoples who are neighbors? I don't know.
I just wonder if we out here, in, like we live in Oregon, probably, I hate to say it, but feel so far removed from the small country of Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just a lousy excuse. Strictly. But so I was wondering if more, besides Florida, if there's more people along the eastern coast that seem to be more adamant? Well, is that not necessary?
I think, you know, Cuba has been so hidden from us as U.S. citizens. When we, for 30, 40 years, when we hear about it in our press, it's usually been negative. And now with more and more people being able to travel to Cuba, I'm hoping that that kind of wall of silence is going to go away. I also think the farm crisis is going to help people to understand that, oh, there's a country there, and we could be connected with them, you know, through markets. But you start connecting in one way, and you learn more about a people, and you start to care about them. And
I think the information or the information provided with the case of Ilian also is opening a lot of eyes and a lot of people. Mm-hmm. That when the father said, you know, I want my kid, I want to go back home, everybody said, no, we have been told that no, everybody in Cuba want to get out. Yeah. What this guy want to go
yeah.
back?
Yeah, what's the deal here? Yeah, he can't possibly mean it.
He don't mean
it. Is he going to ask for asylum?
Yeah, as soon as he stepped in the United States, their grandmothers came over and stayed and went back, and then he came in. But that, somewhere, I might not everybody, a lot of people is gonna think that the only reason he do it because, you know, alien families over there, and they holding everybody else hostage, willing to kill if he don't come back with his family. But I don't really think that everybody see it that way. Yeah. I think it's a volunteer expression. He's working. He got at least he's not a poor Cuban. He got a job. He's working in a hotel. Right. My understanding, and he's gonna get his job back. So. You know, within the revolution, first the people think, well, they give him permission to come out. No, they wouldn't do that. Fidel don't let nobody come out. And that's not true. So I imagine that have done a big impact. And so the people say, well, all these people in Miami, are they saying the truth? Or they don't really have lost the reality of Cuba after 40 years? Mm-hmm. That's what sometimes what's happening. They have been out of Cuba for 40 years.
Why are the people, this is one of the questions you get, why are the people like Ilian's mother getting on a rickety boat and coming? Why is that happening?
Yep. I think there are several reasons. One is they've gone through a really difficult economic period where people have struggled to have enough food. It's getting better now, but they had a very tough time with the end of the Soviet Union where everything was scarce. Cuba had to search for new markets, search for new places that would sell to them. The Soviet Union had 85% of their trade, and overnight that was gone. So economically, people are feeling pinched. That's one reason. They hear from the Cubans in Miami, hey, life is good here. You know, we've got, you know, what did Elian say, got, you know, he had two bikes and he went to Disney World. And I mean, all of those things become an attraction. That's one. Some people leave out of dissatisfaction with the system. You know, it is a socialist state. It's controlled, you know, from the top. The media is not...
But they don't let them leave, is that correct?
20,000 per year is the cap that the U.S. will take to come here. So people sign up, you know, they apply to come. And there's a waiting list, and 20,000 a year come. Some people are impatient and don't want to wait.
So people on the boats are trying to get around America's immigration policy having nothing to do with Cuba saying
it's both. It's both. Because not only do they have to wait for a spot on the U.S. list so they can come, but they also, Cuba charges people exit visa fees, and that's difficult for people to come up with. And it's a big amount. I don't know the amount, but I know that a lot of people in Miami who are trying to get their families to come send chunks of money so they can pay the fees to leave. So there is an immigration fee. Yep, that's part of it.
Yeah, it's tough.
Yep, it's tough. It's tough.
So there's
both an ideological and an economic.
We have a couple in our church. I'm from Vancouver, Washington, and they travel a lot. And they just travel because they like to travel. They're retired, and they are just back from Cuba.
Really?
just a couple who, and they're telling, you know, sitting around the coffee on a Sunday morning, they're saying, well, no, it's not hard to go, you know, we just did dust and so, and oh, that the people were so friendly. They're saying things like you're saying, so maybe that's a little tiny.
But let me, I mentioned it in the first class you went in, the first time you met. There is a problem in Puerto Rico because we have Dominican Republic trying to come in Puerto Rico, same way that the Cubans is doing going to Miami. They gotta go through what is called the Pass of Mona, and that is a very high sea, high risk. Mm. They come 25, 30 in a rowing boat, basically, and they found, like in a monthly basis, 5 die, 10 dies, trying to get from Dominican Republic to Puerto Rico. And you know, they come in Puerto Rico and they become Puerto Rico's territory with citizens. They are not citizens, they got the same immigration problems, they can't deport it back, but they willing to take a chance because economic circumstances in there. They can't go through custom and like quotas and everything else, but the people would like to take chances, and it's happening in Puerto Rico. It's become a problem of immigration in Puerto Rico with the Dominican Republic. You know, be very serious about it. And they are doing what's happening in Chicago, I mean, in the United States with the Mexican. They're taking the low jobs, they're doing a lot of housekeeping and all of that. Mm-hmm. But they'd rather be in Puerto Rico than in Dominican Republic, and they're dying. I mean, on a monthly basis, it's 14 found dead in such and such, Añasco, one of the, you know, borders over there, because of the trying to get out of Dominican Republic. And it's an economic reason, and also the disparity with the government policy, but it's happening.
Let me just, and so I think you're right. I think economic issues are, you know, are really key in why people come. And nobody denies that Cuba is not a place where there are wealthy people. There aren't. But I want to let you know all the different churches that have...
Church of the Brethren.
Yep. Church of the Brethren. I'm not sure I've got it published here, but they've got a statement. No, I don't have it, but they do. National Council of Churches, Christian Reformed Church, which is a pretty conservative church based out of Michigan. Episcopal Church, ELCA, Presbyterian Church USA, Reformed Judaism, United Church of Christ, United Methodist Church, United States Catholic Conference, United States Catholic Relief Services, all have statements similar to the one that I read that the Lutheran Church has.
Right.
So it's a, you know, for us too, I think it can be a matter of faith and something that we can bring to our own congregations to let them know that the situation exists and what does it mean for us as people.